Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. La Mesa residents may soon be voting on a ballot initiative to create a police oversight commission. Meanwhile, in El Cajon, the City Council voted to increase police funding after receiving hundreds of comments, some advocating to defund police or divert funds to social services, while others backed more money for law enforcement. With schools now allowed to reopen in California, how to do so safely and within budget constraints is proving to be a learning experience for local educators. NASCAR champion Jimmy Johnson of El Cajon has taken a strong stand against racism, and we'll have details on today's show. The CHP has beefed up enforcement on Highway 67 to try and reduce motorcycle crashes. And on Crime Beat, the sheriff seeks public help to solve a string of robberies at CVS pharmacies in East County. Many healthcare clinics in California have closed during the pandemic. Hear about efforts to fund reopening them on today's show. And finally, from Public News Service, we'll have some national news stories, including a vote in Congress on granting statehood to Washington, D.C., the latest poll in the Trump versus Biden presidential race, and controversy over the president's nominee to head up the Consumer Affairs Department. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
Jack Hsu, a member of the La Mesa Citizens Oversight Task Force, has proposed a ballot measure to create a strong police oversight board. Hsu proposed the idea during a June 17th meeting of the task force, which was set up by the City Council after a 2018 incident in which a black student at Helix Charter High School was slammed to the ground in handcuffs by a La Mesa police officer. An independent investigation found the officer did not violate procedures. He is still on the La Mesa Police Department's force, but no longer works in schools. The student, Brianna Bell, sued the city, which paid a $130,000 settlement. After missing meetings due to the COVID-19 shutdown, the Citizens Oversight Task Force met following mass protests at the La Mesa police station and a riot. The protests were sparked in part by national outrage over the killing of George Floyd by a white police officer in Minneapolis, and locally, in part by a videotaped incident near the La Mesa trolley station that some characterized as racial profiling. Charges against Amari Johnson, who was accused of assaulting a police officer and resisting arrest in that incident, were dropped after a video failed to back up a La Mesa police officer's account. Police have also drawn criticism for tear-gassing protesters and hitting a woman in the head with a beanbag during a tense standoff at the police station after some protesters threw rocks and bottles at police. The Citizens Oversight Task Force, established before the recent incidents, was formed to make a recommendation to the La Mesa City Council on how and whether to set up a community police oversight board as a watchdog entity. Since La Mesa is a general law city, the City Council does not have oversight power over the police department, unlike charter cities such as San Diego and Los Angeles. The task force discussed how to provide independent and strong police oversight with this limitation. Jack Hsu's proposal would put an initiative on the November ballot, giving voters the ultimate decision. Meanwhile, he says, the City Council could set up an emergency oversight board to investigate concerns over the police handling of the May protests. Hsu says, we have serious complaints we need to address right now. If the ballot measure fails, the Emergency Oversight Board could operate for a year after it was set up. The City Council would also have the option of creating its own oversight board, although it would likely be less strong than the one put to the vote. If the measure passes, the emergency board would be transformed into the permanent board. National City's Police Oversight Board was similarly created through a ballot measure. While Hsu's plan was not approved in the meeting, the group did set up subcommittees and plans three more meetings in July. It could bring a proposal to the City Council on July 28th, the deadline for a measure to reach the ballot. The subcommittees will study the differences between general law and charter cities. whether an oversight board should have subpoena power, and more. The July meetings will include presentations from experts, including a representative of Davis, California, a general law city where the city council set up a community oversight board without using a ballot measure. At the June 17th meeting, the main point of contention was whether a public survey should be conducted to learn what people in La Mesa want, or whether the committee should push for Shoe's fast-track approach. Stephen Evans, the Police Officer Association representative on the task force, cautioned against a knee-jerk reaction to the protests. But other members pointed out that the task force is the result of years of efforts to address perceived police misconduct. Shoe argued that there is an urgent need, noting that 57 people sent public comments to the task force, and none oppose creation of an oversight board. The public has also weighed in during other steps in the process, pushing the city council to create an oversight board in the first place. Some La Mesa residents also hope to restore their city's good name, after national headlines multiple times in the past 2 years put a spotlight on controversies involving the La Mesa police. The next task force meeting will be on July 1st. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Goetz.
El Cajon City Council members received hundreds of comments sent via email on the city's proposed budget, nearly all weighing in on police funding after a nationwide wave of protests over police violence and racial injustice issues. Many of the commenters argued for defunding or shifting some funds away from police into investments in the community and alternatives to handle mentally ill and homeless people, although many others voiced support for El Cajon Police and supported increasing the department's budget. The council unanimously voted for a $120,000 increase for the police. Councilman Gary Kendrick told East County Magazine the motivation is to keep all of the citizens safe. He says, "I don't want to see another Seattle," referencing a police-free anarchy zone set up in several Seattle blocks after police were forced out of their station by protesters. And he adds, "I don't want to have buildings burned down, as happened during a riot May 30th and 31st in neighboring La Mesa." Part of the funds will be used to hire a company to transport people who are arrested to the county jail downtown, allowing police to stay on the street in El Cajon. The city drew criticism from some back in 2016 when Alfred Alongo, an African-American immigrant who suffered a mental health breakdown, was confronted by police, pulled out a vaping device that resembled a gun, and assumed a shooting stance. He was shot and killed by an El Cajon police officer, sparking protest marches, although the district attorney later ruled the shooting was justifiable. But Kendrick notes that El Cajon police officers have used non-lethal weapons to save lives in other tense situations. There was a minority man who was going to throw his little boy over a pass of Highway 67, he recalls. They shot him with beanbags and were able to save the little boy without using guns. El Cajon has about 70 different ethnic groups, says Kendrick, who started the city's America on Main Street Festival to celebrate that diversity. El Cajon has taken some steps in recent years to address calls for police reforms. The city recently banned chokeholds by police, and officers now wear body cameras. Kendrick praises most El Cajon police officers as kind-hearted. For example, Officer Mike Murphy, who was recently featured for choosing not to arrest graffiti taggers and instead getting plywood and finding a place for them to create a work of art. Kendrick says that's one of the reasons we don't have problems like other jurisdictions. But some disagree. Many sent variations of a form letter which noted that El Cajon uses 50% of its budget on police, but only 4% on community development and 11% on public works. Victor Brown from El Cajon wrote, "Public safety must include an investment in housing, health care, food, good jobs, education, free public transit, and resources for small businesses. As issues of police brutality and state violence against black communities and communities of color are highlighted," he adds, "we need to talk about what real safety looks like. Community safety is equitable access to housing and health care, not tear gas and rubber bullets." His letter and many others called for reallocating a large portion of police funds to create mental health resources independent from the police. He adds that in his view, Alfred Alongo was murdered by police in 2016 for simply having an emotional breakdown. Summer Wappler, a homeowner and mother in El Cajon, notes that the homeless crisis is out of control, adding, "We could offer drug counseling, temporary housing, and job placement assistance." She also called for creating community safety and crisis officers. Unarmed officers that can respond to nonviolent requests will help with the overload that our officers currently face, she says. But other residents bristled at the thought of reducing funding for police. Steve LaMarca wrote, "I'm appalled, disgusted. I have interacted with El Cajon Police Department folks for over 30 years and found them to be some of the best cops in the county." He fears that if police were defunded, citizens would be left to fend for themselves when crimes occur. In addition, he notes, "I know agencies have a hard enough time recruiting and keeping officers in this climate of hatred toward them." Carol Babbitt wrote, "I love our police. We need to support them." Adding that police are getting a bad rap because of what she calls several rogue cops who should have been reprimanded and lost their jobs. Sarah Young denounced both the tragic and horrifying misuse of power by Minneapolis police officers against George Floyd, but also the, quote, "chaos, civil unrest, destruction, theft, arson, and otherwise riotous activities that ensued, including burning of buildings in La Mesa." She views increasing tools and training for law enforcement as the right solution to better policing. Some sent in anonymous comments, including a student who wrote of facing discrimination in the school system in El Cajon, while another writer praised El Cajon police as heroes. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Jonathan Getz with an education report. Grappling with how to educate students during the ongoing pandemic is proving to be a learning experience. After the state of California released a 62-page Stronger Together guideline for allowing schools to reopen, the San Diego County Office of Education released its own extensive COVID-19 recovery and reopening plan for the nearly 800 public and 230 private schools in our region. However, Dr. Paul Gotthold, County Superintendent of Schools, cautions, "It's important to note that reopening campuses not only will require a great deal of planning and preparation, but also funding for expenses that would not have been needed before the pandemic. Reopening schools poses challenges for educators at all levels, from primary grades through colleges and universities. Distance learning will likely remain an option this fall for parents and students uncomfortable with in-school instruction. Another option many districts are considering is a blended model, with some in-school and some virtual online instruction. Staggered schedules and other variations on standard school schedules are also in the mix. In-school instruction will look different than in the pre-COVID-19 era, with masks and social distancing requirements, as well as changes to everything from cafeterias to school buses to help protect the safety of students. Districts approaches vary widely. The Grossmont Union High School District has sent out a survey asking parents their views on distance learning versus in-classroom instruction. The La Mesa Spring Valley District, in a letter to parents from Superintendent David Feliciano, indicates that 20% of parents surveyed said they were uncomfortable with students returning to school full-time in the fall and prefer a blended or online-only option. Feliciano assures parents, "Even if we are able to bring all students back on campus in August, we are certain we will be able to offer blended learning and 100% online learning as options for families that have concerns about returning to campus." The Alpine Union School District, in a letter to parents, advises, "The options for students in the Alpine Union School District for the upcoming 2020 to 2021 school year include returning to school, distance learning, a hybrid option, and a homeschool option. The goal of providing multiple ways for students to learn is to allow families to make the decision that will work best for them without having to sacrifice their kids' educational needs." San Diego State University has announced it will hold over 200 in-person classes this fall, but also offer virtual classes. Up to 3,500 students will be able to live on campus, about 54% of capacity. The University of California, San Diego, is planning a phased reopening and will launch a special website later this month with details.
Seven-time NASCAR champion Jimmy Johnson, an El Cajon native, is ending his final year in the sport by taking a strong stand against racism. Earlier this month, NASCAR announced a ban on the Confederate flag, a move long pushed for by Bubba Wallace, one of the most successful African-American drivers in NASCAR history. On June 21st, NASCAR announced that a noose had been found in the Wallace team's stall before the Talladega Super Speedway race in Alabama, which was postponed today due to rainy weather until June 22nd. Jimmy Johnson tweeted, "I can't begin to fathom the pain this action has caused. I stand with you at Bubba Wallace." Now, the U.S. Justice Department and NASCAR launched investigations, producing video evidence that the noose actually had been in the stall since 2019 as a door pull, although the Wallace team, newly assigned to it, was unaware of this. Before the investigation concluded, NASCAR issued a statement which read in part, "There is no place for racism in NASCAR, and this act only strengthens our resolve to make the sport open and welcoming to all." Earlier, Jimmie Johnson took his own strong stand against racism, tweeting, "Due to recent posts on social media, I have decided to end my relationship with Beam Designs." Johnson, along with Wallace and two other drivers, cut their ties with Beam after the helmet designer tweeted an image of the Confederate flag with a message slamming NASCAR for banning it. Beam claimed the Civil War was not about slavery and tweeted, "Ignorance wins again." Johnson's Twitter feed, by contrast, includes recent posts educating his followers on Juneteenth, a celebration of the end of slavery in the U.S. and a symbol of the fight for racial equality. He also posted dismay over the killing of George Floyd by a Minneapolis police officer and quoted Martin Luther King Jr. stating, "Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that." On June 1st, as the nation was embroiled in protests, Johnson wrote, "It hurts to see our country being torn apart by racism and hate. I can't pretend to understand what black men and women have experienced, but I can speak out and condemn racial inequality. I hope love for all mankind can prevail and make changes to build a better future for our children." Shortly before the rescheduled Talladega race on June 22nd, Johnson announced that he would stand with Bubba Wallace during the national anthem. And then, in a show of solidarity, all of the NASCAR drivers in the race joined together to push Wallace's car to the front. Now, Wallace ran out of gas near the end of the race, so another driver pushed his car over the finish line. He finished 14th, and Johnson came in 13th. Johnson praised all the NASCAR drivers who stood up for racial equality, adding, "I'm very proud of our sport." Long viewed as a hometown hero here in San Diego's East County for his racing victories and philanthropy in giving back to local schools, Johnson has now scored yet another win in the eyes of many fans by fighting back against racism and speaking out for equality. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
The California Highway Patrol is deploying extra officers between June 21st and September 30th to increase safety enforcements on State Route 67 from Interstate 8 in El Cajon to Ramona, an area known to locals as Slaughterhouse Alley. The CHP aims to reduce the number of motorcycle crashes caused by unsafe speed, following too closely, unsafe lane changes, improper turning, and additional violations by motorcyclists and other drivers. Many crashes in California end in death or injury as a result of individuals speeding or driving aggressively. In 2019, the CHP's area overseen by the El Cajon CHP office reported 230 injury crashes involving motorcyclists and 20 fatal motorcycle crashes. The enforcement effort is funded through a grant titled Get Educated and Ride Safe, provided by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Goetz.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Jonathan Goetz with a Crime Beat report. An investigation is underway into a robbery at a CVS pharmacy in Alpine that may be part of a series of pharmacy robberies across East County. On June 17th, shortly before 3 p.m., sheriff's deputies responded to a 911 call reporting a robbery at the CVS on Tavern Road. The caller said one of two suspects, armed with a cane, jumped over the counter demanding drugs and took 13 bottles of narcotics. As he fled, he swung the cane around and smashed the glass countertop. The suspects also stole a cell phone from an employee, says Lieutenant Anthony O'Boyle. The suspects fled, but were soon found behind the Alpine Library and arrested. Both are 15 years old, from San Diego and Spring Valley. They have been charged with robbery and booked into juvenile hall. Detectives believe this robbery may be part of a series. If you have any information on this crime or others that are similar, contact Detective Jason Worthington at the Alpine Sheriff's Station, 619-659-2600. You can also remain anonymous and call tips in to Crime Stoppers at 888-580-8477 or download the P3 Anonymous Tip app at sdcrimestoppers.org. You may be eligible for up to a $1,000 reward for information that leads to an arrest.
About 200 health centers across the state have closed their doors during the pandemic because the number of patient visits dropped by half, leading advocates to push for more federal relief. They do get some CARES Act funding, but the Paycheck Protection Act specifically excluded clinics with more than 500 employees. Carmela Castellano-Garcia with the California Primary Care Association says 22 of the state's largest clinics are really hurting financially.
We are swept up in the funding allocations that are not specific to health center needs. And so therefore, our needs have not been addressed. So that is why we will continue to push for health center specific funding.
The latest tranche of federal funding allocated dollars for safety net hospitals, but excluded health centers. So advocates are asking the Department of Health and Human Services to carve out a specific fund for the centers. Castellano-Garcia says the state's community health centers provide health care to millions of low-income Medi-Cal patients, a population that is only going to grow as job losses mount.
There are 1,300 sites serving 7.2 million people. We are seeing 1 in 3 of the state's Medi-Cal recipients and 1 in 6 Californians.
Many health centers are hanging on by offering more visits over the telephone to reduce the spread of COVID-19. Currently, 50% of visits are done over the phone, a trend that may persist after the pandemic subsides. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for June the 26th, 2020. I'm Mike Clifford. Spurred on by recent anti-racism protests around the nation, today the U.S. House is voting to make the District of Columbia the 51st state, our Diane Bernard reports.
The historic vote is the first on the issue since 1993 and seeks to correct what is seen as a long-time injustice rooted in racism, according to Monica Hopkins with the ACLU of D.C. She points out that the 700,000 mostly black residents have never had voting representation in Congress. At the same time, Congress has complete authority over the district and can even veto city council moves, as when President Donald Trump ordered the National Guard to dominate recent protesters at the White House against the D.C. mayor's wishes.
The entire nation focusing in on these protests in D.C. and how, you know, the Trump administration came down with a heavy hand really highlighted the inequities of living without representation.
The bill is likely to pass the House, but faces opposition from Senate Republicans who claim the district is too corrupt and financially dependent on the federal government to be a state. White House officials have said the president would veto the legislation if it reaches his desk.
D.C. residents pay the highest federal taxes per capita in the U.S., according to the D.C. Statehood Commission. President Trump has lost significant ground in 6 battleground states that clinched the Electoral College victory in 2016, that according to the New York Times Siena College survey, with Joseph Biden opening a double-digit lead in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. The Times reports that Trump's once commanding advantage among white voters has nearly vanished. Mr. Biden now has a 21% lead among white college graduates, and the president is losing among white voters in 3 northern battleground states, not by as much, but he won those states by nearly 10 points in 2016. Consumer advocates now expressing concerns over the Trump administration's choice to lead the Consumer Product Safety Commission.
The nominee, Nancy Beck, is a longtime lobbyist for the American Chemistry Council. Ed Mrzewinski with the Arizona Public Interest Research Group says past affiliations make her a poor choice for the consumer agency.
Nancy Nancy Beck has worked to deregulate chemicals, not to protect people. She came to Washington 3 or 4 years ago and was embedded at the EPA. She has been part of the deregulatory apparatus that is trying to take away consumer and environmental protections.
White House officials point to Beck's experience touting her PhD in toxicology and more than 20 years of experience in risk management. Both Arizona Senators, Democrat Kyrsten Sinema, and Republican Martha McSally have so far declined to say how they plan to vote. Mark Richardson reporting.
This is PNS. Many men believe they are less vulnerable to COVID-19, and that has consequences for how safe they really are during this pandemic. A new survey conducted by the U.S. and U.K. finds women are more likely to wear face masks than men are. Family medicine physician Scott Itano with Kaiser Permanente Washington says the issue is what he calls toxic masculinity.
They're less likely to be vulnerable or show signs of weakness. And I think wearing masks and seeking care from a doctor to them feels like showing a sign of weakness or being vulnerable.
This mindset could come at a high cost. According to Washington State Department of Health data, 54% of COVID-19 related deaths have been men. Starting today, face masks are required in public in Washington State. The Ohio Supreme Court has greenlighted a fast-track process that gives homes to developers but fails to compensate owners and taxpayers.
Three justices joined the majority opinion but declined to comment on the constitutional issues in the case involving what are known as administrative foreclosures. The court said it would not stop the process because the law governing these procedures was not patently and unambiguously unconstitutional. Former Ohio Attorney General Mark Dinn represented Elliot Feltner in the case, a Cleveland landowner whose foreclosed property went to a land bank instead of a sheriff's sale.
They dismissed it on very narrow procedural grounds. We kind of played that round of this fight to a draw. But at least two of the judges, including the Chief Justice, in the written opinion, really invites us to take a look at this taking issue.
Dinn says he is litigating similar issues, one in Montgomery County and one in Cuyahoga County. Administrative foreclosures send abandoned properties to a county's board of revision. This story was produced with original reporting from Lucia Walinchis for ION Ohio, the Ohio Center for Investigative Journalism. It is funded in part by the Ohio News Media Foundation and the George Gunn Foundation and produced in association with Media in the Public Interest.
And finally, our Eric Tegenoff explains Oregon stands out on the West Coast for the way its voting districts are drawn.
Unlike neighbors California, Idaho, and Washington, redistricting in Oregon is a political process decided by the party in power. The threat of gerrymandering is high. Executive Director of Common Cause Oregon, Kate Titus, says politicians typically draw districts behind closed doors using elaborate data.
If you move that line over one block and include this block in this district instead of that district, how's it going to affect their political power? So that sophisticated analysis is happening. It's just not open to the public.
Titus says a coalition of groups is looking to change that. Signatures are being collected for an initiative to create an independent, nonpartisan redistricting commission.
Districts are drawn once a decade, and that happens next year using the 2020 census data. This is Mike Clifford, hoping you are keeping a safe distance. And thanks for wrapping up your week with Public News Service. We're member and we're listener supported and online at publicnewsservice.org.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Royalty Free Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine Radio Show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
The East County Magazine Show airs Mondays and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com.
Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. La Mesa residents may soon be voting on a ballot initiative to create a police oversight commission. Meanwhile, in El Cajon, the City Council voted to increase police funding after receiving hundreds of comments, some advocating to defund police or divert funds to social services, while others backed more money for law enforcement. With schools now allowed to reopen in California, how to do so safely and within budget constraints is proving to be a learning experience for local educators. NASCAR champion Jimmy Johnson of El Cajon has taken a strong stand against racism, and we'll have details on today's show. The CHP has beefed up enforcement on Highway 67 to try and reduce motorcycle crashes. And on Crime Beat, the sheriff seeks public help to solve a string of robberies at CVS pharmacies in East County. Many healthcare clinics in California have closed during the pandemic. Hear about efforts to fund reopening them on today's show. And finally, from Public News Service, we'll have some national news stories, including a vote in Congress on granting statehood to Washington, D.C., the latest poll in the Trump versus Biden presidential race, and controversy over the president's nominee to head up the Consumer Affairs Department. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
Jack Hsu, a member of the La Mesa Citizens Oversight Task Force, has proposed a ballot measure to create a strong police oversight board. Hsu proposed the idea during a June 17th meeting of the task force, which was set up by the City Council after a 2018 incident in which a black student at Helix Charter High School was slammed to the ground in handcuffs by a La Mesa police officer. An independent investigation found the officer did not violate procedures. He is still on the La Mesa Police Department's force, but no longer works in schools. The student, Brianna Bell, sued the city, which paid a $130,000 settlement. After missing meetings due to the COVID-19 shutdown, the Citizens Oversight Task Force met following mass protests at the La Mesa Police Station and a riot. The protests were sparked in part by national outrage over the killing of George Floyd by a white police officer in Minneapolis, and locally, in part by a videotaped incident near the La Mesa trolley station that some characterized as racial profiling. Charges against Amaree Johnson, who was accused of assaulting a police officer and resisting arrest in that incident, were dropped after a video failed to back up a La Mesa police officer's account. Police have also drawn criticism for tear-gassing protesters and hitting a woman in the head with a beanbag during a tense standoff at the police station after some protesters threw rocks and bottles at police. The Citizens Oversight Task Force, established before the recent incidents, was formed to make a recommendation to the La Mesa City Council on how and whether to set up a community police oversight board as a watchdog entity. Since La Mesa is a general law city, the City Council does not have oversight power over the police department, unlike charter cities such as San Diego and Los Angeles. The task force discussed how to provide independent and strong police oversight with this limitation. Jack Hsu's proposal would put an initiative on the November ballot, giving voters the ultimate decision. Meanwhile, he says, the City Council could set up an emergency oversight board to investigate concerns over the police handling of the May protests. Hsu says, we have serious complaints we need to address right now. If the ballot measure fails, the Emergency Oversight Board could operate for a year after it was set up. The City Council would also have the option of creating its own oversight board, although it would likely be less strong than the one put to the vote. If the measure passes, the emergency board would be transformed into the permanent board. National City's Police Oversight Board was similarly created through a ballot measure. While Hsu's plan was not approved in the meeting, the group did set up subcommittees and plans three more meetings in July. It could bring a proposal to the City Council on July 28th, the deadline for a measure to reach the ballot. The subcommittees will study the differences between general law and charter cities. whether an oversight board should have subpoena power, and more. The July meetings will include presentations from experts, including a representative of Davis, California, a general law city where the city council set up a community oversight board without using a ballot measure. At the June 17th meeting, the main point of contention was whether a public survey should be conducted to learn what people in La Mesa want, or whether the committee should push for Shoe's fast-track approach. Stephen Evans, the Police Officer Association representative on the task force, cautioned against a knee-jerk reaction to the protests. But other members pointed out that the task force is the result of years of efforts to address perceived police misconduct. Shu argued that there is an urgent need, noting that 57 people sent public comments to the task force, and none oppose creation of an oversight board. The public has also weighed in during other steps in the process, pushing the city council to create an oversight board in the first place. Some La Mesa residents also hope to restore their city's good name, after national headlines multiple times in the past 2 years put a spotlight on controversies involving the La Mesa police. The next task force meeting will be on July 1st. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
El Cajon City Council members received hundreds of comments sent via email on the city's proposed budget, nearly all weighing in on police funding after a nationwide wave of protests over police violence and racial injustice issues. Many of the commenters argued for defunding or shifting some funds away from police into investments in the community and alternatives to handle mentally ill and homeless people, although many others voiced support for El Cajon Police and supported increasing the department's budget. The council unanimously voted for a $120,000 increase for the police. Councilman Gary Kendrick told East County Magazine the motivation is to keep all of the citizens safe. He says, "I don't want to see another Seattle," referencing a police-free anarchy zone set up in several Seattle blocks after police were forced out of their station by protesters. And he adds, "I don't want to have buildings burned down, as happened during a riot May 30th and 31st in neighboring La Mesa." Part of the funds will be used to hire a company to transport people who are arrested to the county jail downtown, allowing police to stay on the street in El Cajon. The city drew criticism from some back in 2016 when Alfred Alongo, an African-American immigrant who suffered a mental health breakdown, was confronted by police, pulled out a vaping device that resembled a gun, and assumed a shooting stance. He was shot and killed by an El Cajon police officer, sparking protest marches, although the district attorney later ruled the shooting was justifiable. But Kendrick notes that El Cajon police officers have used non-lethal weapons to save lives in other tense situations. There was a minority man who was going to throw his little boy over a pass above Highway 67, he recalls. They shot him with beanbags and were able to save the little boy without using guns. El Cajon has about 70 different ethnic groups, says Kendrick, who started the city's America on Main Street Festival to celebrate that diversity. El Cajon has taken some steps in recent years to address calls for police reforms. The city recently banned chokeholds by police, and officers now wear body cameras. Kendrick praises most El Cajon police officers as kind-hearted. For example, Officer Mike Murphy, who was recently featured for choosing not to arrest graffiti taggers and instead getting plywood and finding a place for them to create a work of art. Kendrick says that's one of the reasons we don't have problems like other jurisdictions. But some disagree. Many sent variations of a form letter which noted that El Cajon uses 50% of its budget on police, but only 4% on community development and 11% on public works. Victor Brown from El Cajon wrote, "Public safety must include an investment in housing, health care, food, good jobs, education, free public transit, and resources for small businesses. As issues of police brutality and state violence against black communities and communities of color are highlighted," he adds, "we need to talk about what real safety looks like. Community safety is equitable access to housing and health care, not tear gas and rubber bullets." His letter and many others called for reallocating a large portion of police funds to create mental health resources independent from the police. He adds that in his view, Alfred Alongo was murdered by police in 2016 for simply having an emotional breakdown. Summer Wappler, a homeowner and mother in El Cajon, notes that the homeless crisis is out of control, adding, "We could offer drug counseling, temporary housing, and job placement assistance." She also called for creating community safety and crisis officers. Unarmed officers that can respond to nonviolent requests will help with the overload that our officers currently face, she says. But other residents bristled at the thought of reducing funding for police. Steve LaMarca wrote, "I'm appalled, disgusted. I have interacted with El Cajon Police Department folks for over 30 years and found them to be some of the best cops in the county." He fears that if police were defunded, citizens would be left to fend for themselves when crimes occur. In addition, he notes, "I know agencies have a hard enough time recruiting and keeping officers in this climate of hatred toward them." Carol Babbitt wrote, "I love our police. We need to support them." Adding that police are getting a bad rap because of what she calls several rogue cops who should have been reprimanded and lost their jobs. Sarah Young denounced both the tragic and horrifying misuse of power by Minneapolis police officers against George Floyd, but also the, quote, "chaos, civil unrest, destruction, theft, arson, and otherwise riotous activities that ensued, including burning of buildings in La Mesa." She views increasing tools and training for law enforcement as the right solution to better policing. Some sent in anonymous comments, including a student who wrote of facing discrimination in the school system in El Cajon, while another writer praised El Cajon police as heroes. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Jonathan Getz with an education report. Grappling with how to educate students during the ongoing pandemic is proving to be a learning experience. After the state of California released a 62-page Stronger Together guideline for allowing schools to reopen, the San Diego County Office of Education released its own extensive COVID-19 recovery and reopening plan for the nearly 800 public and 230 private schools in our region. However, Dr. Paul Gotthold, County Superintendent of Schools, cautions, "It's important to note that reopening campuses not only will require a great deal of planning and preparation, but also funding for expenses that would not have been needed before the pandemic. Reopening schools poses challenges for educators at all levels, from primary grades through colleges and universities. Distance learning will likely remain an option this fall for parents and students uncomfortable with in-school instruction. Another option many districts are considering is a blended model, with some in-school and some virtual online instruction. Staggered schedules and other variations on standard school schedules are also in the mix. In-school instruction will look different than in the pre-COVID-19 era, with masks and social distancing requirements, as well as changes to everything from cafeterias to school buses to help protect the safety of students." Districts' approaches vary widely. The Grossmont Union High School District has sent out a survey asking parents their views on distance learning versus in-classroom instruction. The La Mesa Spring Valley District, in a letter to parents from Superintendent David Feliciano, indicates that 20% of parents surveyed said they were uncomfortable with students returning to school full-time in the fall and prefer a blended or online-only option. Feliciano assures parents, "Even if we are able to bring all students back on campus in August, we are certain we will be able to offer blended learning and 100% online learning as options for families that have concerns about returning to campus." The Alpine Union School District, in a letter to parents, advises, "The options for students in the Alpine Union School District for the upcoming 2020 to 2021 school year include returning to school, distance learning, a hybrid option, and a homeschool option. The goal of providing multiple ways for students to learn is to allow families to make the decision that will work best for them without having to sacrifice their kids' educational needs." San Diego State University has announced it will hold over 200 in-person classes this fall, but also offer virtual classes. Up to 3,500 students will be able to live on campus, about 54% of capacity. The University of California, San Diego, is planning a phased reopening and will launch a special website later this month with details.
Seven-time NASCAR champion Jimmy Johnson, an El Cajon native, is ending his final year in the sport by taking a strong stand against racism. Earlier this month, NASCAR announced a ban on the Confederate flag, a move long pushed for by Bubba Wallace, one of the most successful African-American drivers in NASCAR history. On June 21st, NASCAR announced that a noose had been found in the Wallace team's stall before the Talladega Super Speedway race in Alabama, which was postponed a day due to rainy weather until June 22nd. Jimmy Johnson tweeted, "I can't begin to fathom the pain this action has caused. I stand with you at Bubba Wallace." Now, the U.S. Justice Department and NASCAR launched investigations, producing video evidence that the noose actually had been in the stall since 2019 as a door pull, although the Wallace team, newly assigned to it, was unaware of this. Before the investigation concluded, NASCAR issued a statement which read in part, "There is no place for racism in NASCAR, and this act only strengthens our resolve to make the sport open and welcoming to all." Earlier, Jimmy Johnson took his own strong stand against racism, tweeting, "Due to recent posts on social media, I have decided to end my relationship with Beam Designs." Johnson, along with Wallace and two other drivers, cut their ties with Beam after the helmet designer tweeted an image of the Confederate flag with a message slamming NASCAR for banning it. Beam claimed the Civil War was not about slavery and tweeted, "Ignorance wins again." Johnson's Twitter feed, by contrast, includes recent posts educating his followers on Juneteenth, a celebration of the end of slavery in the U.S. and a symbol of the fight for racial equality. He also posted dismay over the killing of George Floyd by a Minneapolis police officer and quoted Martin Luther King Jr. stating, "Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that." On June 1st, as the nation was embroiled in protests, Johnson wrote, "It hurts to see our country being torn apart by racism and hate. I can't pretend to understand what black men and women have experienced, but I can speak out and condemn racial inequality. I hope love for all mankind can prevail and make changes to build a better future for our children." Shortly before the rescheduled Talladega race on June 22nd, Johnson announced that he would stand with Bubba Wallace during the national anthem. And then, in a show of solidarity, all of the NASCAR drivers in the race joined together to push Wallace's car to the front. Now, Wallace ran out of gas near the end of the race, so another driver pushed his car over the finish line. He finished 14th, and Johnson came in 13th. Johnson praised all the NASCAR drivers who stood up for racial equality, adding, "I'm very proud of our sport." Long viewed as a hometown hero here in San Diego's East County for his racing victories and philanthropy in giving back to local schools, Johnson has now scored yet another win in the eyes of many fans by fighting back against racism and speaking out for equality. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
The California Highway Patrol is deploying extra officers between June 21st and September 30th to increase safety enforcements on State Route 67 from Interstate 8 in El Cajon to Ramona, an area known to locals as Slaughterhouse Alley. The CHP aims to reduce the number of motorcycle crashes caused by unsafe speed, following too closely, unsafe lane changes, improper turning, and additional violations by motorcyclists and other drivers. Many crashes in California end in death or injury as a result of individuals speeding or driving aggressively. In 2019, the CHP's area overseen by the El Cajon CHP office reported 230 injury crashes involving motorcyclists and 20 fatal motorcycle crashes. The enforcement effort is funded through a grant titled Get Educated and Ride Safe, provided by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Goetz.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Jonathan Goetz with a Crime Beat report. An investigation is underway into a robbery at a CVS pharmacy in Alpine that may be part of a series of pharmacy robberies across East County. On June 17th, shortly before 3 p.m., sheriff's deputies responded to a 911 call reporting a robbery at the CVS on Tavern Road. The caller said one of two suspects, armed with a cane, jumped over the counter demanding drugs and took 13 bottles of narcotics. As he fled, he swung the cane around and smashed the glass countertop. The suspects also stole a cell phone from an employee, says Lieutenant Anthony O'Boyle. The suspects fled, but were soon found behind the Alpine Library and arrested. Both are 15 years old, from San Diego and Spring Valley. They have been charged with robbery and booked into juvenile hall. Detectives believe this robbery may be part of a series. If you have any information on this crime or others that are similar, contact Detective Jason Worthington at the Alpine Sheriff's Station, 619-659-2600. You can also remain anonymous and call tips in to Crime Stoppers at 888-580-8477 or download the P3 Anonymous Tip app at sdcrimestoppers.org. You may be eligible for up to a $1,000 reward for information that leads to an arrest.
About 200 health centers across the state have closed their doors during the pandemic because the number of patient visits dropped by half, leading advocates to push for more federal relief. They do get some CARES Act funding, but the Paycheck Protection Act specifically excluded clinics with more than 500 employees. Carmela Castellano-Garcia with the California Primary Care Association says 22 of the state's largest clinics are really hurting financially.
We are swept up in the funding allocations that are not specific to health center needs. And so therefore, our needs have not been addressed. So that is why we will continue to push for health center specific funding.
The latest tranche of federal funding allocated dollars for safety net hospitals, but excluded health centers. So advocates are asking the Department of Health and Human Services to carve out a specific fund for the centers. Castellano-Garcia says the state's community health centers provide health care to millions of low-income Medi-Cal patients, a population that is only going to grow as job losses mount.
There are 1,300 sites serving 7.2 million people. We are seeing 1 in 3 of the state's Medi-Cal recipients and 1 in 6 Californians.
Many health centers are hanging on by offering more visits over the telephone to reduce the spread of COVID-19. Currently, 50% of visits are done over the phone, a trend that may persist after the pandemic subsides. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for June the 26th, 2020. I'm Mike Clifford. Spurred on by recent anti-racism protests around the nation, today the U.S. House is voting to make the District of Columbia the 51st state. Our Diane Bernard reports.
The historic vote is the first on the issue since 1993 and seeks to correct what is seen as a long-time injustice rooted in racism, according to Monica Hopkins with the ACLU of D.C. She points out that the 700,000 mostly black residents have never had voting representation in Congress. At the same time, Congress has complete authority over the district and can even veto city council moves, as when President Donald Trump ordered the National Guard to dominate recent protesters at the White House against the D.C. mayor's wishes.
The entire nation's focusing in on these protests in D.C. and how, you know, the Trump administration came down with a heavy hand really highlighted the inequities of living without representation.
The bill is likely to pass the House, but faces opposition from Senate Republicans who claim the district is too corrupt and financially dependent on the federal government to be a state. White House officials have said the president would veto the legislation if it reaches his desk.
D.C. residents pay the highest federal taxes per capita in the U.S., according to the D.C. Statehood Commission. President Trump has lost significant ground in 6 battleground states that clinched the Electoral College victory in 2016, that according to the New York Times Siena College survey, with Joseph Biden opening a double-digit lead in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. The Times reports that Trump's once commanding advantage among white voters has nearly vanished. Mr. Biden now has a 21% lead among white college graduates, and the president is losing among white voters in 3 northern battleground states, not by as much, but he won those states by nearly 10 points in 2016. Consumer advocates now expressing concerns over the Trump administration's choice to lead the Consumer Product Safety Commission.
The nominee, Nancy Beck, is a longtime lobbyist for the American Chemistry Council. Ed Mrzewinski with the Arizona Public Interest Research Group says past affiliations make her a poor choice for the consumer agency.
Nancy Beck has worked to deregulate chemicals, not to protect people. She came to Washington 3 or 4 years ago and was embedded at the EPA. She has been part of the deregulatory apparatus that is trying to take away consumer and environmental protections.
White House officials point to Beck's experience touting her Ph.D. in toxicology and more than 20 years of experience in risk management. Both Arizona Senators, Democrat Kristen Sinema, and Republican Martha McSally have so far declined to say how they plan to vote. Mark Richardson reporting.
This is PNS. Many men believe they are less vulnerable to COVID-19, and that has consequences for how safe they really are during this pandemic. A new survey conducted by the U.S. and U.K. finds women are more likely to wear face masks than men are. Family medicine physician Scott Itano with Kaiser Permanente Washington says the issue is what he calls toxic masculinity.
They're less likely to be vulnerable or show signs of weakness. And I think wearing masks and seeking care from a doctor to them feels like showing a sign of weakness or being vulnerable.
This mindset could come at a high cost. According to Washington State Department of Health data, 54% of COVID-19 related deaths have been men. Starting today, face masks are required in public in Washington State. The Ohio Supreme Court has greenlighted a fast-track process that gives homes to developers but fails to compensate owners and taxpayers.
Three justices joined the majority opinion but declined to comment on the constitutional issues in the case involving what are known as administrative foreclosures. The court said it would not stop the process because the law governing these procedures was not patently and unambiguously unconstitutional. Former Ohio Attorney General Mark Dinn represented Elliot Feltner in the case, a Cleveland landowner whose foreclosed property went to a land bank instead of a sheriff's sale.
They dismissed it on very narrow procedural grounds. We kind of played that round of this fight to a draw. But at least two of the judges, including the Chief Justice, in the written opinion, really invites us to take a look at this taking issue.
Dinn says he is litigating similar issues, one in Montgomery County and one in Cuyahoga County. Administrative foreclosures send abandoned properties to a county's board of revision. This story was produced with original reporting from Lucia Walinchis for Ion Ohio, the Ohio Center for Investigative Journalism. It is funded in part by the Ohio News Media Foundation and the George Gunn Foundation and produced in association with Media in the Public Interest.
And finally, our Eric Tegenoff explains Oregon stands out on the West Coast for the way its voting districts are drawn.
Unlike neighbors California, Idaho, and Washington, redistricting in Oregon is a political process decided by the party in power. The threat of gerrymandering is high. Executive Director of Common Cause Oregon, Kate Titus, says politicians typically draw districts behind closed doors using elaborate data.
If you move that line over one block and include this block in this district instead of that district, how's it going to affect their political power? So that sophisticated analysis is happening. It's just not open to the public.
Titus says a coalition of groups is looking to change that. Signatures are being collected for an initiative to create an independent, nonpartisan redistricting commission.
Districts are drawn once a decade, and that happens next year using the 2020 census data. This is Mike Clifford, hoping you are keeping a safe distance. And thanks for wrapping up your week with Public News Service. We're member and we're listener supported and online at publicnewsservice.org.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Royalty Free Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine Radio Show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
The East County Magazine Show airs Mondays and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com.